session number 17365, Reel 3.
Mr. Waddington, Reel 3, you're just saying what happened after 30 ops.
Yes, 30 ops or a few more, and you then became an instructor, as I say. So we were then doing nothing. It had got very hot by that time. I think it was April, May even. And there was some fellows who'd completed the tours before me, and they were waiting to go home by boat. And it was a very anxious time, really. Just, you had nothing to do. The days dragged by. You didn't know when you were going to go home. Eventually, this other lot got away, including Jack Williams. I don't know why he went home before I did, as he arrived after me. But anyway, he went home with George Tushler and others. And we had to wait then. Now, at one time during this waiting period, we were told that we were going to fly home from Alexandria. So we got on a train, a few of us, including Baird Smith, and went. I was a sergeant, of course, and we trained to Alexandria. Nothing came of it. We didn't fly home. I think he flew home, but I don't know anything about the inside workings of it. And so within a few days, we were back again at Shirufa, absolutely pig sick. In Alexandria, it wasn't a very nice place to be because the troops were coming back from Greece and they didn't like the Air Force because they never saw us flying. They just thought we hadn't been there. And so you didn't really go out into the town. Anyway, eventually the time came for us to leave Egypt. And I think it was a Monday morning when we went down to Suez. A whole squad was there to wave us off. Envious, of course. There must have been perhaps 10 or 20 of us, I suppose, going. And we got to the docks at Suez and got on a boat, a Polish boat, called the Sobieski. And very soon afterwards, we set sail and sailed down the Red Sea. The heat was unbearable. We slept on the deck at night. Even that was almost unbearable. On the way down, we called at... I can't remember the name. There's a port on the right-hand side as you're coming down. Port Sudan, would it be?
Yes, there is a Port Sudan.
Port Sudan. And we went ashore there. Your shadow was right under your feet, you know, because the sun was almost overhead. I don't know what we called in there for. I've no idea. But then we went on further south and got into the Indian Ocean at the bottom of the Red Sea. And it became cooler. We landed at Mombasa, which I think is in Kenya, or it was. Had only a few hours there. We were able to go ashore and walk about amongst the greenery and see. I can't remember anything particular there. But then we set sail again. We went to Durban. There, we stayed for quite a few days. Now, the South Africans, as everybody knows, or did in those days, were very, very hospitable. We'd heard about this in Egypt, that people who'd come out to Egypt by boat said, you know what wonderful people that were there, they take you home and feed you and all this sort of thing. And three or four of us were in a shop one afternoon, and this girl and this fella just came up and started talking to us. And said, would you like to come, you know, home with us and have something to eat? Oh, that's just what we're looking for. See? So they took us out in their car, or perhaps two cars, I don't remember, out into the country, and they lived on a sugar plantation with their parents. I don't think we ever saw it in daylight. But it was a big, fine house, and they gave us a meal, and it happened to be their parents' silver wedding day. Well, I mean, normally you wouldn't invite strangers if it was your parents' silver wedding, really, would you? But they did. And we had a fine time there. I don't know why, but I made a speech about their wedding anniversary and thanked them very much for having us. Then they took us back to the ship, which we'd changed ships in Durban. We got onto the SS Strathaird, a P&O liner, I think it was, of 20,000 tons. Very comfortable. So these friends that we'd met said they wanted to take us the next day to the Durban July Handicap. Now, that's a horse race in Durban, which is equivalent to our Derby. It's the biggest horse racing event of the summer. So, yes, they would call for us and all that sort of thing. And with that in mind, we went to sleep. To our horror, the next morning, when we woke up, we were out at sea. We'd left Durban. They never, of course, told you that we're leaving tomorrow because of secrecy and that sort of thing. We went then to Cape Town. must have had at least 2 weeks in Cape Town. We went up Table Mountain, up a railway, which, I mean, I'm not very good at heights, although I was flying, but I was horrified going up this cable railway, because I think it's about 3,000 feet. And when you get up there, it's very, very windy. And, you know, my knees were absolutely shaking when we stepped off this thing at the top. It's quite flat on the top, and there's a cafe, and it was cold. But it was something to have gone up Table Mountain, something to have seen it, let alone. Now, I did I did meet a girl there, but she didn't take me home. But I remember necking her with her one night in an open-air market. And we were sort of leaning on this stall, and suddenly it fell over, and all these apples went all over the ground. How terrible. Another occasion I can remember being at a dance, and when the dance finished, I don't remember them playing God Save the King, but they did play, "There'll always be an England as long as Yorkshire's there," or something, whatever the words were. They played that to finish the dance with. They had such a love of England in that time. I suppose a lot of them were English born, or their parents were, and so forth. We used to go out and eat there. Of course, we didn't have all that much money. You had to really be careful what you did, but you know, how you spent your money. I don't ever remember going to the pictures. It's difficult to really remember exactly what we did do. But eventually we sailed from Cape Town, which time it must have been July. Must have been July there then. And we went all the way across the South Atlantic, unaccompanied, because this boat could do 20 knots. But the whole of the way home back to Glasgow, it used to alter course every 2 minutes, zigzagging, because they told us that it takes a minimum of 2 minutes for a U-boat to get its sights on you and get its aiming thing all set up. So that was it. It every 2 minutes. I mean, we were then, of course, in Cape Town. It was winter, really. You wouldn't have thought so. We never had coats on. But we sailed to Trinidad in the West Indies, and we went ashore there. I did a bit of shopping. How long we were there, I don't remember, but we lived on the boat. Then we went further east across the Caribbean Sea, the Sargasso Sea, I think it's called. So there's a lot of seaweed there. To Honduras, which is one of the countries in the little bit that connects North and South America. There's a strip. And we went there to pick up 300 black men who were foresters, and these poor fellows were coming to Scotland to chop trees down. That was a most wonderful day, a most wonderful, colourful day. We had to anchor out. There was no harbour there. We anchored out in the bay, and all these fellows were ferried out on boats, and all the natives from miles around came out on boats. So we're all surrounded by these things, all playing guitars and singing calypsos. It was a most wonderful day. The sun was shining, of course. It was hot, and all these poor fellows got on, and they entertained us on the way home, of course, while they're singing and so forth. I think that was all about that, really. That was, we were only there a few hours, I think. Then we went back to Trinidad. Perhaps refuel there, I don't know. And then we set out on the last leg. I mean, we'd no idea where we were going, of course. Nobody ever told you where you were going. Because in case you got sunk and captured, and you know, they might give away information. I did read once in a book that the month before, a sister ship of the Strathair had actually been sunk in the South Atlantic by a U-boat doing the same journey. And like us, it had a lot of Italian prisoners of war on. I didn't mention that, but we were bringing these prisoners of war back from Egypt, presumably Egypt, into Britain. And I think they then went across, whether they went back across to America, I don't really know. But, yes.
You were saying some were lost in the sinking of the ship.
Yes. Yes, there was a lot lost, and it caused quite a row between the Germans and the Italians, because the Germans had sunk the ship, and the Italians reckoned that they should have known that there were Italian prisoners of war on the ship, and so there'd be an awful lot of Italians would drown, because they would be down in the bottom of the ship, wouldn't they?
Yes.
Anyway, nobody fired on us. I never saw any U-boats, but we used to look out all the time for them. I remember that for the whole of that journey coming home, I had a most awful cold, dreadful cold. I mean, you know, one of those colds when you can't taste anything. I don't know why. I had a birthday while I was at sea, I remember, and having a drink of beer which I couldn't taste. There were also two occasions when we had funerals, when I don't know who it was that died, but they slid this body over the side that cut the engines just for a very short period. The ship didn't stop, and I suppose there was a parson there, and they just shot this body in. It was wrapped in something, of course. I don't know whether it was an Italian or whether it was one of the crew. It certainly wasn't one of us, our lot. One, I think, was found in the swimming pool, drowned in the morning, I believe they said. So anyway, we've sailed to Glasgow. Is it Renfrew, perhaps, the port at Glasgow, might be. Arriving there in August. Went from there to... A lot of the fellows had brought back guns and all this sort of thing. I remember Tussler, ammunition and guns and things, which the customs people were looking for. However, we then went straight down on the train to Uxbridge in London. After a very short period, we went on leave. Caught a train at King's Cross. I was carrying a suitcase which I'd bought somewhere, and it was so full that the handle came off. So there's about 25 kilogram suitcase, trying to carry it without a handle was extremely difficult. I arrived home on a Sunday morning via Doncaster, got into Hull about 5 in the morning, Sunday morning, got a taxi, went home. I think I must have rung home from London, because the only people at home were my sister and who'd got my girlfriend staying with her, which was absolutely delightful. My mother had got TB and she was in Scarborough and my father was with her. So
I think we're coming on to your period of instruction now.
Yes, yes.
How did you like being an instructor as opposed to being on operations?
Yes. It was fine. I was eventually posted, after leave, I was posted back to Harwell, strangely enough. Now, at Harwell, they were still doing the same thing, training bomber crews, but there was also a ferry flight. And I got onto the ferry flight, and along with some of the other fellows who'd been in Egypt and come back on the same boat as I did. There were 3 or 4 of us, old friends at Harwell. The ferry flight used to receive brand new Wellington aeroplanes, plus fully trained crews who had been sent to the Middle East. So it was our job to instruct them on how to get to the Middle East and what it was like when they got there. And I was there for 2 whole years. It was a most enjoyable time because there was no ops, didn't do much flying, a wonderful part of the country to be along the Thames there. Some wonderful villages, pubs and that sort of thing.
Did you actually fly any planes out to the Middle East yourself?
I did one of the 1,000 bomber raids from there, much to our horror. When they did the 1,000 bomber raids, they took crews from things like units like mine or the OTUs with people who'd not with sprogs on, but with people like me who'd been on tour. So we went to Hamburg, I think it was Hamburg, the middle one. It was uneventful, but frightening.
Why was it so frightening compared with the other operations?
Well, because a lot more people were getting shot down. Now, you knew about these things. You knew that it had hotted up tremendously. Our plane had the letters BOG on it, so we called it a flying shithouse. So I went once back to the Middle East. We went on a liaison trip, which was a bit of a racket, really. But we were away about a fortnight, and we flew out to Morocco, to Tripoli, to Tobruk. But at that time, North Africa was free of Germans, of course. A few days in Cairo and back home again, loaded up with oranges and nylon stockings. Talking about navigation, when we were coming home, we set off home from Gibraltar eventually, and it tells you. This is an illustration of what it's like if you don't know what the wind is. We were to fly north. A name for Land's End, right up the sea the whole of the way. Well, there was no means of getting any pinpoints because you were over the sea the whole of the time. So we flew on the Met wind. Now, the Met wind was coming from the north. It was supposed to be coming from, now, 360 is north. It was supposed to be coming from about 355 degrees, whereas in fact it was coming from about 003 degrees. So we'd altered course, or our course was slightly to the left because to counteract the wind, which we expected was blowing us. In effect, we were going more and more west the whole of the way because the wind was actually on the other side of us. So when it came to finding Land's End, by which time it had come light, and we'd had to fly all past the French, the western French coast, which was in German hands. So in getting daylight then, when we came to find Land's End, we couldn't find it at all. We didn't know really where we were. I think the wireless operator got a bearing which seemed to suggest that we were not far out, but we then spotted something. We thought, this is Land's End. But it wasn't. It was the extreme west coast of Ireland. So we turned home and turned to the right and flew home. And that was it. Now, when I got back to Harwell, to my horror, I found that Baird Smith had called at Harwell to see me, and he wanted me to go back on ops with him. That was the last thing in the world I wanted, to be quite honest. I really didn't want to go back on ops anymore. I was quite happy to see the war out at Harwell. I had a nice girl there, and things were quite comfortable. But however, although I was frightened to go back, I was more frightened of refusing to go back. So we said we'd go back. And Raymond Ridley, who'd been on 37 Squadron in Egypt, was also at Harwell with me. And he was bamboozled into coming with us, so that was three of us. That was three of the crew. So we trained again at Harwell. During those 2 years, by the way, Baird Smith, who was well connected, he'd married a very beautiful girl called Vivian Bodleian, after the library in Oxford, the Bodleian Library, I think. She was the niece of Sir John Anderson, who was his Home Secretary. So he was well connected. In fact, there was a picture, the first picture in one of the Tatlers that came out, that was a sort of society magazine, on the front page was Baird Smith getting married to Vivian. We met her once because she brought her down and we all went into the pub and she was absolutely delightful. She really was delightful. However, it didn't stop her carrying on with the Yanks when he was a prisoner of war, and that was the end of their marriage. She died quite young of TB, strange enough, he told me once. So we went back then on ops, and it would be in December, I think. We were posted to a conversion unit. I wasn't looking forward to it at all. He converted onto Lanks, and I don't know really what we did. That was at a place near Oakington, but it wasn't Oakington. It was just nearby, this conversion unit. And there we all got Christmas leave. And after Christmas, we went back, and that was the first time I went to Oakington, I think. To 7 Squadron. 7 Squadron was a Pathfinder squadron. We were going on to Pathfinders. Baird Smith had got us onto Pathfinders because they wanted experienced crews on Pathfinders. Already at 7 Squadron was a fellow called George Ryle, who'd been on our crew in Egypt. George Ryle, by then, that time, he'd become a squadron leader. He was a gunner, and he was a gunnery officer at 7 Squadron. He was killed in the end. Poor George. So we trained on these Lanks for about 2 or 3 weeks, just doing cross countries, learning more about G and H2S, which are the radio direction finding things, you know. There's the wonderful things with the G. I mean, you could tell in England
where you were to nearly half a mile, I would think. It wasn't so good the further east you went. H2S was a thing which, it was an instrument which you carried in the plane and which sent rays down to the ground and reflected on a little television screen in front of you. And you could tell which were towns. It was very good at picking out coastlines. It was just like seeing them in daylight, because the rays were deflected at a different angle if it was water or if it was roofs of houses as opposed to grassland. So that was the navigation age that we had. And so we set off on our first, and I can't tell you, I can't not emphasize how frightened I was. I don't know really why I got so frightened, but my imagination I used to imagine being shot down and being in a plane which was blazing. We were all fighting to get out, these terrible things. I used to drink like a fish in the hope that I would get to sleep, but it didn't really help me a lot. I'd really just wanted to go home to Mummy. I suppose many of us were like that, but it was a thing that you never, ever talked about. I never remember saying to somebody, God, I'm bloody scared of this, or anybody saying it to me. It's just funny that you just carried on with this sort of mock humour and cracking jokes. The first dot we went on, we had to come back because we got over the North Sea and the guns wouldn't work. The rear gun wouldn't work. I mean, why the bloody rear gun wouldn't work, I don't know. So, I mean, you'd gone through all the trauma of the day, being briefed, working out your courses, fretting and sweating and getting more and more terrified. And then you just came back from the North Sea without ever doing anything, dropping your bombs in the sea thing. Another week went by, and we set off. There was a briefing, and to everybody's horror, when they pulled the curtains away, it was Berlin was the target. A great groan went up, of course, because that winter, 44, I should say, was when they were really giving Berlin a hell of a pasting. I mean, they would drop. I once read a book called A Northeast Coast Town, and it was about the bombing of Hull. It was written by a man called Garrity, who might have been the town clerk or something at the time. But one of the jobs he had to do for the Home Office was report the weight of bombs which had fallen on Hull on each raid. How he told the weight of the bombs, I don't know, because, I mean, the bombs had all exploded. But at the end of the book, he listed the whole of the raids which had gone on in Hull during the war, and with the tonnage. And out of curiosity, I added all these up, and it came to 405 tons. The whole of the war. I mean, I puzzled over this for ages, so much so that I got the book out of the library again and checked it, and I found that it was quite right. So I rang the corporation one day, and I aired this view, and they said, well, Mr. Garrett is dead now, but at the Farron's Art Gallery, the archives are there if you want to go and see them, which I never did do. I never did do. It's in the book. Now, 405 tons, and we know the damage that was done to Hull in the war. There was, hundreds of houses were damaged. Hundreds of people made homeless. Dozens and dozens killed. But yet we would fly on this raid to Berlin. There'd be 750 planes. They would carry more than 2,000...